they suitably censorious of the violence? At the time, did their public remarks match their private horror? Those questions have been heatedly and extensively hashed out over the days since the House Committee released text messages from 6th of January, in which Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham, the popular hosts of primetime shows on Fox News, separately implored President Donald Trump's chief of staff to get Donald Trump to say and do something to disperse the protesters and quell the violence. Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham knew that he had stirred those protesters and could sway them, more so than they ever acknowledged on air, according to their critics. According to Hannity and Ingraham, they're just the victims, yet again, of left-wing media smears. You can delve into the weeds of this, or you can pull back and survey the whole ugly yard. And what you see when you do that, what matters most in the end, is that Fox News has helped to sell the fiction that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump. And there's a direct line from that lie to the rioting. There's a direct line from that lie to various Republicans' attempts to develop mechanisms to overturn vote counts should they dislike the election results. That lie is the root of the terrible danger that we're in, with Donald Trump's supporters being encouraged to distrust and undermine the democratic process. And that lie has often found a welcome mat at Fox News. The Washington Post media critic Eric Wemple is among the many attuned observers who have documented this, and a column of his from mid-January 2021 presented a compendium of inciting commentary on Fox News Channel in the lead-up to 6th of January. Interviewing Donald Trump on 29th of November 2020, the Fox business host, Maria Bartiromo, declared, "We cannot allow America's election to be corrupted. We cannot." On Sean Hannity's show just 2 days later, the Fox News host, Jeanine Pirro, vented an apocalyptic outrage about Joe Biden's election victory, saying, "This fraud will continue and America will be doomed for the next 20 years. The Fox News contributor Newt Gingrich, the Fox business host Lou Dobbs, Sean Hannity himself, all of them got in on the action to some degree or other, stating or signaling that something about the 2020 presidential election was terribly amiss. But where is their evidence? It was fugitive then, and no one has tracked it down since. That's because it doesn't exist. It's a conspiracy-minded, ratings-driven hallucination. Just this week, the Associated Press published a review of every potential case of voter fraud in the 6 battleground states where Donald Trump has disputed Joe Biden's victory. It found fewer than 475 cases. Joe Biden won Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and their 79 Electoral College votes by a combined 311,257 votes out of a total of 25.5 million ballots cast for president, the Associated Press reported. The disputed ballots represented just 0.15% of his victory margin in those battleground states. The cases could not throw the outcome into question, even if all the potentially fraudulent votes were for Joe Biden, which they were certainly not, and even if those ballots were actually counted, which in most cases they were not. This mathematical analysis hardly supports the hysteria on the right, a hysteria that Fox News readily whips up. I direct you to the so-called documentary Patriot Purge on Fox Nation, in which Tucker Carlson recasts 6th of January as evidence that a corrupt government is setting up and locking up Donald Trump's supporters, who are really political prisoners. And this is no garden variety partisan hysteria. It circles around and sometimes lands squarely on the contention that Joe Biden is an illegitimate president and Donald Trump is our rightful ruler, exiled to the Siberia of southern Florida. I know the pushback from the right. It was Democrats who refused to accept Donald Trump's legitimacy by insisting that he, in cahoots with Russia, cheated his way into the Oval Office. They rushed the judgment as more than a few sympathetic journalists indulged or floated rococo scenarios well beyond anything provable. But, Democrats weren't passing or trying to pass laws in battleground states that would enable them to counter the popular will. Democrats weren't trying to enshrine rule by the minority. Many Republicans are doing precisely that right now. And they're being motivated and cheered on, both directly and obliquely, by what they see and hear on Fox News Channel. I care less about Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham's precise words on 6th of January than about what they and their colleagues on Fox News said before and after, and what they're saying right now. It's reckless, it's subversive, and it's scary.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how Pakistan's economic woes are prompting it to look for short-term solutions and why IMF programs are raising eyebrows. And we shall take a look at how the protracted U.S. war in Afghanistan harmed children and why their plight has no end.
With rising inflation and weakening currency taking a heavy toll on people's lives in Pakistan, Prime Minister Imran Khan's beleaguered government finds itself under tremendous pressure to look for short-term solutions. The South Asian country of 220 million has had a long history with the International Monetary Fund, with 22 programs in 70 years. Despite these programs failing to touch deeper structural issues in Pakistan, the country, reeling from a historic economic slump, has again turned to the controversial lender for help, thus raising eyebrows.
Pakistan, a member of the International Monetary Fund since 1950, has been in the Global Financial Lenders programs repeatedly owing to its volatile economic health. In May 2019, the Imran Khan government reached a $6 billion 39-month loan agreement with the IMF to bail out the country's impoverished, debt-ridden economy. It required the Pakistani government to commit to structural reforms and reducing public debt, which experts fear could curb growth and increase inflation. On November 22, after more than 2 years of jockeying over reform commitments, the IMF agreed to revive the stalled program. But it demanded more budgetary tightening before approving the next tranche of some $1 billion, bringing total disbursements to about $3 billion so far. On December 3, Pakistan said it was ending exemptions on sales tax to appease the international lending body. Opposition parties in Pakistan claim that the agreement will hurt the poor and downtrodden. The 2021-22 budget, they argue, is laden with tax measures proposed by the IMF that are essentially anti-poor and designed to increase inflation. The agreement will force the Imran Khan government to tighten its purse strings, which means no cash handouts or subsidized grains to the country's poor.
Pakistan is in the throes of a deep economic crisis. The South Asian country requires gross external financing of $51.6 billion within a two-year period to revive its impoverished economy. While the Imran Khan government has applied for a hefty bailout package from the IMF, the debate over whether to go or not to go to the international lending body has become intense in economic circles of the country. Experts say dependence on the IMF should not be a long-term strategy.
Pakistan Institute of Development Economics, a government-affiliated public policy think tank, has proposed well-researched policy prescriptions that could end the country's dependence on the International Monetary Fund. In a report published on December 10, it says dumbing the international lender could be a long-term plan if the government makes prudent policy and shows the ability to implement it. The prestigious policy think tank rues the fact that Islamabad has time and again approached the IMF with bailout requests while no effort has been made to deal with the country's own long-term policy and structural deficiencies. It says the time for the government to reevaluate its approach to policy decisions has come, which until now has remained whimsical. The report cites the example of Malaysia's former Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, who refused to go to the IMF. He did all that was required to put Malaysia's back on track without bailouts. Many also believe that going to the IMF will make Islamabad subservient to the US, which is the largest contributor to the international lending body. Washington has used it as a bargaining chip to force crisis-stricken Pakistan to allow US military bases in the country. Not going to the IMF would mean not allowing the global hegemonic powers to dictate policies.
Now to have more insights, we are joined by Mr. Asim Khan, former PTI UK chapter president. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Now Pakistan is one of the few countries most familiar with the International Monetary Fund, with a total of 22 programs in 70 years. So why does Pakistan keep going to the IMF?
Hello to everyone. I think one of the primary factors is that over the years in the past, as Pakistan has taken 20 bailout programs from IMF. What happened was all the previous governments, where the money should have been spent in terms of carrying structural reforms, institutional stability on initiatives, and so on and so forth, that did not take place. And as a result of that, we kept going back to IMF every successive government. And when we took over in 2018, we did not want to go with IMF, but we had no choice left because the balance of payment crisis and all sorts of things were creeping up. And basically, we had inherited one of the worst and draconian balance of payment crisis that had been left by the previous government. And we only had, we literally had in the state bank, we literally had $8 to $9 billion. So these were the things that actually made us revert back to IMF. Not that Pakistan actually wanted to go with IMF, but we had no choice left. And these were difficult decisions. So this is the reason and the background to why we have gone with IMF now. because of the previous government and what they've done.
Mr. Khan, there's a general belief that the IMF bailout packages can work as a short-term strategy but should be dumped in the long term. Now, what's your take on this?
I think absolutely. I agree with you that. I think any country would vouch for the fact that anyone who is borrowing money for any organizations of the world, be it the World Bank or the IMF, it may work out in the short term. And even for us in Pakistan, even that did not work in the short term as well. So let alone talking about the long term. So yes, I totally agree with the statement that IMF, borrowing money from IMF is never going to be a long-term solution. Long-term solution lies somewhere else. And that's where your strength, and that's what the government is trying to do, to actually invoke policies and initiatives that are long-term and that are for the welfare of the people of Pakistan. And for that, we need to have structural reforms. We need to actually have tax collections mechanism actually sorted out. We need to introduce digital transformation within our systems and institutions. So there are a number of things that are going on currently. Yes, it may seem difficult. It may seem that all sorts of noises are coming forward, but in the long run, it will bring all the benefits.
Mr. Khan, there are also concerns about structural reforms as demanded by the IMF, which many fear could curb growth and increase inflation. Now, do you think it puts the Imran Khan government in a difficult situation?
I think, as I said earlier on, that because of the fact that we had in 2018, when we took power from PMLN, the history was very bleak. The financial history of Pakistan, it was a mess. We were literally on the verge of being defaulted. The inflation had gone up. Exports were literally not much, and the exports, what we were doing were is the raw products. So now the focus is that we are going to be spending a lot of money in social sector as well. So we've launched one of the major programs to alleviate poverty as well, to bring the lower working class actually at a certain level, and to have those skills that will become the enabling factor for manufacturing as well, because you need three areas where the growth will come in. One being manufacturing, secondly the agriculture, third being the service industry, and to wrap it up, that's where the digital world and the IT technologies will play its part. And Pakistan has already started to see the effects of that dividend in IT industry and the products that are going out. The IT services that we are exporting out, our exports are rising as well. But as I said earlier on, that because the dollar was fixed at such a price by the previous governments, and in particular the last government, that the imports, we were importing heavily, but we had nothing to export. And whatever we were exporting, it was not enough to actually balance out the BOP crisis.
Thank you, Mr. Khan. So glad to have you on the program. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Mir Muhammad Ali Khan, a Lahore-based investment banker, notes that Imran Khan government has won some great concession from IMF, which means the bill will be tabled in parliament for amendments. Social media activist Waqar Malik says Americans will use the IMF to retaliate against Pakistan for its growing ties with China, while hoping that Beijing will come to Pakistan's rescue. Senior Pakistan People's Party politician Sarafroz Rojor quotes party chief Bilawal Zardari as saying that as long as the IMF deal continues, the people of Pakistan will continue to suffer. You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
recently the news of an Afghan mother from northern Jowzan province selling one of her newborn twins hogged headlines across the world. It brought to light two disturbing realities in present-day Afghanistan, the worsening U.S.-manufactured food crisis and children bearing the brunt of it. Hundreds of thousands of children across the crisis-stricken country face acute malnutrition, and most of them also face a harsh winter without proper shelter. This comes as the U.S. and its allies refuse to unfreeze Afghanistan's assets and facilitate the flow of humanitarian aid.
3 months since the U.S.-led international coalition beat a hasty retreat from Afghanistan and announced freeze on its assets, the country is teetering on the brink of a major humanitarian crisis. According to aid agencies and human rights watchdogs, children are the worst affected. The war-ravaged country that the U.S. and its allies occupied for 20 years is facing its worst hunger crisis ever seen. Save the Children has warned that more than half of the children under 5 may suffer from acute malnutrition amidst harsh winter. It also notes that 800,000 children in Afghanistan lack proper shelter or blankets amid sharp dip in temperature. UN officials report that more than 14 million children across the country face acute food insecurity. Many children have already starved to death amid severe food crisis, and many more are believed to be a step away from famine. UN and other international agencies have warned of more deaths this winter with worsening food insecurity and sheer apathy of the West. Reports of poor Afghan families selling their children for not affording their food bear testimony to the disastrous legacy of U.S.-led foreign powers in Afghanistan. The unfolding crisis, in particular the pitiful plight of children, should always weigh heavily on the American conscience.
One of the most defining but underreported characteristics of the U.S.-led military occupation of Afghanistan over the last two decades has been the harm caused to children. Thousands of children perished in America's carpet bombings, drone strikes, and night raids that went largely unnoticed. From Kunduz in the north to Khost in the south and Jalalabad in the east, U.S.-led forces unleashed a reign of terror, making no distinction between children and adults who were later conveniently forgotten by the world.
In a report released on August 31, Save the Children, the world's leading aid organization for children, said almost 33,000 children were killed and maimed in Afghanistan over the past 20 years, an average of one child every 5 hours. The figure did not include children who died due to hunger, poverty, and disease during that time. The real number of direct child casualties of the conflict, the aid organization said, is likely to be much higher. The report, drawing attention to the crisis triggered by the botched exit of Americans from Afghanistan in August, said nearly half of the population of Afghanistan, including nearly 10 million children, was in need of humanitarian assistance even before the recent turn of events unfolded. A total of 1,598 children suffered casualties during this time, it said, including 785 children killed and 813 injured. While these figures pertain to last 5 years alone, the U.S. perpetuated war crimes against children in Afghanistan began soon after Pentagon carpet bombed the country in October 2001, leaving trail of death and destruction. Thousands of children vanished in U.S. air raids, which toppled the Taliban.
Now to have more insight, I'd like to welcome Mr. Mick Wallace to the program, a member of the European Parliament for Ireland South. Mr. Wallace, 3 months since the botched U.S. exit from Afghanistan and the freezing of assets, millions of children in the country face starvation and death. Now, do you hold the Biden administration responsible for it?
Yes, the Biden administration bears a lot of responsibility for the present situation, in the sense that things are really, really bad and they're not prepared to do the right thing. But obviously, the problems in Afghanistan go back many years. So, I mean, different American governments and different support from the European Union and NATO have obviously brought us to this terrible place. Last week, we had a very good discussion in the European Parliament. The ambassador for Iran in Belgium, in Brussels, his name is Ghulam Hossein Dayani. He came in and he answered questions to MEPs for over an hour and a half. And many of them were on Afghanistan. And I think a lot of the MEPs were a bit shocked that things are so bad, because we haven't really been hearing much in the media here for a while. The Afghan story has lost its attraction, and the media has moved on to other things, which is obviously terrible. But he pointed out that this winter, 23 million people in Afghanistan will be food insecure. He pointed out that 3 million children under the age of 5 are already suffering from severe malnutrition. Children are dying slowly, he said. And he said Iran is doing its best on the border, but is getting hampered by sanctions from the US and the EU, unfortunately. And this is absolutely criminal. There's already, before the Taliban took over in August, there was already 3.6 million Afghan refugees in Iran. And that's a UN figure. I heard a UN guy say that about 6 or 7 weeks ago in the parliament here. That's unbelievable. And yet, instead of helping Iran to deal with that, the Americans and the Europeans are refusing to help Iran deal with the problem. They're freezing money belonged to the Afghan government because they don't like the Taliban. Well, I tell you what, they can like a government or not like him, but it's the people they're persecuting right now. So the Biden administration is directly responsible for young people dying in Afghanistan today. That is 100% sure.
Mr. Wallace, there's been reports about a poor Afghan family selling their children amid the severe food crisis. Now, what should the international community do to force the U.S. to unfreeze Afghanistan's assets?
Well, listen, it's not rocket science. American administrations don't really care about people. They don't really care about their own, so it's probably a bit much expecting them to care about the people of Afghanistan. But what I would be saying to the European Union, who is a major partner of the U.S., I'd be saying to the European Union, who tells us every day how much they care about human rights, that it's about time that they actually show that they really care. And if they want to do that, they need to change their approach to Afghanistan right now, or there's going to be terrible, terrible things happening there this winter. The EU, whether the US are up for it or not, but the EU has to unfreeze the money. The EU has to help more. It has to take on board that this is a humanitarian catastrophe that could be unprecedented. And we are sleepwalking. It's almost as if we're waiting for things to get worse before we do anything about it. And I think it's paramount now, and there's a huge responsibility on the European Union to actually do something constructive to help the people and to start working with the Taliban government. They can hold their nose and not like the Taliban, but they've got to help the country of Afghanistan now. And remember, the problems today in Afghanistan didn't fall out of the sky. And unfortunately, the European Union propped up a corrupt Afghan government for many years. The European Union and its member states were involved in the NATO that were as much a part of the problem as the Americans, helping to destroy the place and destroy so many lives. We have a huge responsibility now to the people of Afghanistan.
Mr. Wallace, in a report in August, Save the Children said almost 33,000 children were killed or maimed in U.S. and Afghan airstrikes over the past 20 years. So why is there no accountability for such war crimes?
Listen, where have you seen accountability anywhere? When have we ever had accountability? The winner makes up the rules. There's no international law in that area anymore. I mean, why didn't Clinton, George Bush, the two George Bushes, Obama, Trump, why didn't they ever face a criminal court? They all committed war crimes. Tony Blair committed war crimes in Iraq. He walks around a free man. Julian Assange is in prison for exposing the war crimes that many of these people were involved in. So the person who tells the truth and exposes them is in prison, and the people who committed the war crimes walk free. We have a big problem. International law has broken down, and it started with the Americans refusing to recognize it anymore. Israel refuses to recognize it. And sadly, more and more, I see the European Union engaging in illegal sanctions and coming up with their own rules-based order instead of recognizing the UN Charter and the international law that was formed after 1945.
Mr. Wallace, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sana Said, a US-based journalist, says a million children in Afghanistan may possibly die this winter as the US-imposed freeze on Afghan assets remains in place. She calls it barbaric. Afghan-American activist and mental health therapist Nahid Fatahi refers to the killing of 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children, in a U.S. drone strike in Kabul to highlight U.S. war crimes in her home country. Rashida Yousafzai, an Afghan-Australian journalist, says women are forced to sell their children in Afghanistan as famine threatens the lives of 1 million children.
And that was our episode about Pakistan's economic crisis and IMF's ineffective programs, and also children paying the heavy cost of America's military adventures in Afghanistan. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. current war budget costs taxpayers more than $2 billion a day, or $7.7 trillion over the next decade. Wouldn't adopting a more reasonable military budget and closing the failed Guantanamo Bay prison give Americans the money to get started? Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by David Pottori, writer. This article is titled, Guantanamo Hasn't Made Americans Safer. Stay tuned for more. A recent Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on closing Guantanamo Bay prison coincided with Congress's approval of a $778 billion military budget that no one asked for. It was, in fact, $25 billion more than the Commander-in-Chief had requested. This congressional largesse to the military went largely undebated and unnoticed, in stark contrast to the firestorm of controversy accompanying even a hint of appropriations for healthcare, education, and infrastructure. The U.S. current war budget costs taxpayers more than $2 billion a day, or $6.7 trillion over the next decade. Contrast that with proposed infrastructure spending over those same 10 years, and you get a good picture of Congress priorities. $7.7 trillion for the military and $3.5 trillion for infrastructure, a figure certain to decline. The U.S. spent more on military than the next 11 nations combined, including China, Russia, and India. The Senate hearing, which featured panelists ranging from military generals to Colin Kelly, a 9/11 family member, affirmed that the prison and military tribunal system chosen to try those suspected of war against the U.S. has been an utter and abject failure, wasting taxpayer dollars and resulting in only two convictions in 20 years. The United States spent $6 billion since opening the prison and currently spend $13 million per prisoner per year to keep it open. Today, there are 39 detainees in Guantanamo, and after two decades, more than two-thirds of them have never been charged with a crime. 13 have been recommended for transfer but haven't been released, and 12 are in a military commission system in which only two have been convicted. In contrast, the stateside Department of Justice has successfully prosecuted nearly 1,000 individuals on terrorism-related charges in that same period of time. The prosecution of prisoners at Guantanamo remains at an impasse because of the use of torture by the U.S., making a hash of attempts to bring defendants to trial at all, and overclassifying of information, making it impossible to bring certain evidence to trial even after it has been made publicly available through the media. Kelly, a 9/11 family member who, with other people, co-founded September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, noted that 20 years after the events that took the lives of many people around the world, no one has been held accountable. According to some U.S. senators, also 20 years and $8 trillion into the so-called war on terror, including $6 billion for Guantanamo, people are exactly where they were 20 years ago, just as vulnerable and just as likely to be attacked. That's not an endorsement of military's efficacy, it's an argument for a new approach. Given the growing list of terrors Americans deal with every day, the terror of not having a place to live or enough food to eat, the terror of not having physical and mental health care, the terror of gun violence and police violence, the terror of poverty and debt, the prospect of a Guantanamo detainee coming down their chimneys in 2021 rings particularly hollow. But it does beg the questions. If the U.S. spends more than $2 billion a day on national defense, why are so many Americans afraid? Shouldn't that expenditure earn them the right to walk around without a care in the world? And if $2 billion a day isn't enough, what is? It's fair to ask, what would America look like if officials spent $2 billion a day on education, affordable housing, healthcare, or infrastructure? Wouldn't these things make them safer and more free? And wouldn't adopting a more reasonable military budget, it's better to call it war military budget, and closing the failed Guantanamo Bay prison give Americans the money to get started? economic divide.
Racial and ethnic inequality and racism, these are issues that are widespread in the U.S. But what if these issues came at an economic cost and not just small amounts? What if they ran in the trillions of dollars? Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwai. That appears to be the case in the U.S., which is what we will be looking at in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, these are some of the highlights. Racial inequality, racial output, $51 trillion lost in U.S. GDP. The exclusion of minorities, African-Americans and Latinos in that mix is something that is highlighted in reports that have come out, one from a Federal Reserve CEO. Also, the roots of inequality, something that the U.S. Is plagued by, and some of the consequences, jobs, education, and pay, things that inequality shows itself in these different sectors. And one of the other highlights of our report and of our program today would be how COVID-19 has exposed inequality in the U.S., its impact on minorities, which has been more than whites, and how blacks and minorities are actually more jobless because of COVID-19.
Economic Divide looked at a study from a source within the U.S., Mary Daly, the San Francisco Federal Reserve president. She has said, the imperative for equity, for closing some of these gaps, is not only a moral one, but is also an economic one. The study looked at three factors at the base. If black and Hispanic men and women held jobs at the same rates as whites, if they completed college at the same rates as whites, and if they earned the same as whites. From labor alone, they figured the gains would add up to $22.9 trillion over 30 years, from the years 1990 to 2019. The larger $51.2 trillion estimate factors in an increase in capital investments that a more productive labor pool could be expected to trigger.
So we looked at, our thought experiment was, what if we equalized by gender, men and women, by race, different racial groups, and gave people the same opportunities in education, employment, occupational choice, and even how well they're allocated to jobs that demand the skills that they've already acquired. And what we found is all of those things matter. The big ticket items, of course, were getting people the right amount of education, and then getting them in positions that are equivalent to their education, and having them paid appropriately for the education and skills that they've earned. And those were things that, you know, they increase innovation, they increase productivity, and importantly, and this is the main bottom line, they increase economic output. We estimated that over the last 30 years, it's $30 trillion in lost economic output to our country.
So racial discrimination in the United States, that does not take us by surprise, even though it has reached alarming levels in that country. Yet looking at social media posts, it is still quite revealing what is not being done about it, which in turn is reflected economically in that country. I mean, take this entry, which is actually from the White House itself. It said the racial wealth gap has direct roots in discriminatory federal, state, and local policies. Well, let's take a look at what Joe Biden said, the current U.S. president, on his campaign trail. In this clip, which you're going to see, delivering remarks on his Build Back Better plan, which is on advanced racial equity in America's economy.
Most people wouldn't even think the Fed has anything to do with this. Its existing mandate promotes maximum employment and stable prices. Under my plan, I believe the Fed should add that to that responsibility and aggressively target persistent racial gaps in jobs, wages, and wealth, revise its hiring and employment practices, and achieve greater diversity at all levels of that institution, including diverse nominees for the Board of Governors and the regional banks.
Well, there you have Biden himself talking the reality, and it's glaringly obvious here how the U.S. is aware of the discrimination that's taking place. That it's not providing a fair representation out there when it comes to all segments of the society. And here is a person citing one of the unfortunate realities out there when it comes to people of color, especially African Americans. Now, the real aim of this program, how minorities, especially African Americans, are the hidden economy of the U.S. as represented through these successful African Americans.
I'm going to do this in reverse order. So first I'm going to introduce Tristan Wilkerson. He's a general partner of High Street Equity Partners, focusing on investor relations, capital raising, and performance. Tristan is an experienced policy professional, angel investor, an entrepreneur with demonstrated success in both the public and private sectors. He's a former congressional aide. Our next speaker is Ron Busby. Ron is the president and CEO of the U.S. Black Chambers. Ron is a former successful business owner himself. He has been recognized as one of the nation's best CEOs.
Now, it wouldn't be fair if there was not an African-American female representation.
And last but not least, Alilia Bundles is the author of On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker, which is the New York Times notable book about her entrepreneurial great-great-grandmother that was the inspiration for Self-Made, a fictional four-part Netflix series starring Octavia Spencer.
Okay, joining us in the studio is Graylin Hagler. He is a pastor and justice advocate. We also have the pleasure of having Marzia Hashmi with us. No need to introduce you, Marzia. Thank you, first of all, for coming.
Thank you for
Journalist,
inviting me.
Activist, and media personality. Okay, first let's listen to Graylin Hagler. Graylin, we have this report that is the basis of our program indicating that $51 trillion has been prevented from being contributed to the U.S. GDP and the segments of society in the U.S., minorities, which includes African Americans and also Latinos. Let me get your reaction on that, on why this has happened and if authorities are going to do anything about it, because they are aware of that this has actually happened.
Well, why they're not reacting to it is because there has been a historical and persistent racism that has existed in the United States of America, a discrimination from before emancipation. I mean, folks were held as chattel slaves at one point in this country. And then with the emancipation of the Emancipation Proclamation after the Civil War, folks were so-called set free. But there had been always numbers of things that continued to sabotage the economic advance of the black community, such as the Congress and their mismanagement of the Freeman's Savings Bank, which left 61,000 depositors with losses of nearly $3 million in 1874.
Yeah, well, the list goes on, as he was about to say there. Mary-Jay, this is what's incredible here. We know about the discrimination. And that's what I want to hear from you about in summary form. And then you have the other side where minorities and African Americans are included in that, in a sense. They have been prevented from contributing to the U.S. GDP in terms of the economy, as he just cited some examples. So tell us what you think about that and if you have even personal experiences that you may contribute here.
Right. It is quite a paradox, Kaveh. On the one hand, you have the United States with the greatest economy in the world. And on the other hand, you have this minority group, especially African Americans, I'll look at that side of things, that have been prevented from even contributing to that economy in the way that they could have. And so in the long run, the United States has actually shot itself in the foot from actually preventing some of its citizens from reaching their potential. Yes, of course, I agree with Reverend Hagler and what he says, and of course I have personal experience. I don't think that there's a black American, especially my age for sure, who has not experienced that. I grew up in a time that black parents taught their kids, you have to understand where you are, you have to work twice as hard to get half as far.
Yeah, and what's spectacular in this whole thing is the fact that you have U.S. authorities who are aware of that, and you have the current U.S. president on his campaign trail, in which he talked about how they're going to set aside a fund for people who have been prevented from actually getting their fair share or shake to contribute to your society. We're going to listen to him, and then I'll come back with a reaction from you.
That's what racial equity in our economy looks like. Here's another step we're going to take under my Build Back Better plan to fully include more people into the deal. We're going to strengthen the Federal Reserve's focus on racial economic equity.
All right, on his campaign trail, so I don't know if it's him making that then to get votes, or if he actually means what he's saying. Do you believe the president and whether he's going to follow through? I mean, how can you change something that's been in the U.S. society for so long in terms of discrimination?
We're talking about systemic racism.
Right.
We're talking about a system that has to be changed, not an individual that can make certain promises. We look at over the years, we have seen many candidates and many presidents even make many promises. I mean, even under the presidency of Obama, as a matter of fact, the situation with Black Americans became worse. So, no, I don't think that there's anything that is going to be done just from a promise.
Very well. I wish we had more time to talk about this, but we do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Marzia Hashemi, here with us, journalist, activist, and media personality.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for coming in. We had Pastor and Justice Advocate Graylin Hagler speak to us before that. Now, the following is another experience of a person, either of color or a minority, and his or her experience with how they have been held back from contributing to the U.S., at least economic cycle.
The opportunity for good jobs, it wasn't there, you know, and sadly to say, you know, where I live in New Orleans, is what I've experienced. I think it was more who you know at that time to get that job, and you didn't have to have a degree. And it's just so sad to say it because a lot of people, they struggle because of that. You know, there were times where even with school, you know, I couldn't even get my sons in a decent school.
Our infant news section is upon us, and as the end of the year is approaching us, can you believe it? We are not coming short on topics. Well, our first topic is about wealth inequality. A new report has revealed that the richest 1% took 38% of new global wealth since the year 1995, and the bottom half got just 2%. They went on to say that global inequities in wealth and income are, quote, about as great today as they were at the peak of Western imperialism in the early 20th century. There you go. That's how it stands. Next story, inflation. How many more times are we going to talk about this? But it is something that's persisting. Money-hungry corporations, this entry said, are to blame for it. Corporate profiteering is forcing workers and families to make unnecessary sacrifices so that wealthy executives can make themselves richer. And, of course, that means their pay. While the pay for median employees, well, that fell by 8%. So, obviously, you're looking at the inequality that happens there as a result of that. It's called the wage gap. Next up, we go to Sri Lanka. The economy there is not doing well. We reported on this a few months ago, and the problem is still there. As food and energy prices are soaring, Sri Lankans are going without their basic necessities. Now, one reason that is cited is that the Sri Lankan government, its efforts to hold on to foreign exchange reserves, is blamed for creating shortages of basic goods as a result. And a final look at news from this, or recent news, I should say, global arms sale. A recent report came out, and this is really not surprising, that weapons trade is booming. Profits are hitting record profits. Overall, $531 billion is what it came at for the year 2020. And the top five companies, they're all from the U.S. And one part of the world that has sold the most weapons to, West Asia, otherwise known to the rest of the world as the Middle East. And, of course, again, that comes in at a record. Well, the end of the year is upon us. And with that, we would really like to hear from you when it comes to, for example, topics that we should cover, like in this section, before the year is actually over. But the contact information is behind me. Make sure you drop us a line so that we can cover a story, especially in your part of the world.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact and countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is our in-depth section, which we will drive home how the disparities between whites and other races, which amounts to racial discrimination, cost the U.S. economy trillions of dollars. Let's take a look at the disparities between black and white men. We looked at businessmen. Here you have a white businessman, $100, and for the black businessman, they're $5.04. Now, what does this mean? It means for every $100 of white wealth, black families have only $5.04, if you can believe that. Now, the disparity also holds for wealthier black families. The 99th percentile black family is worth a mere, what do we have, $1,574,000, while the 99th percentile white family is worth over $12 million. That's a little less than $11 million, according to the Survey of Consumer Finances. Now, unemployment's great gauge of how the disparity shows itself there. People of color, which includes black, Latinos, Asian whites, and then all. When it comes to whites, they have a lower unemployment compared to the rest of them. The green line here, these are the whites. The timeline was February 2020 all the way through to December 2020. Let's try to get some sense out of it. Joining us for a breakdown of this is Darwin Fishman. He's a lecturer in sociology at San Diego State University in California. So Darwin, welcome. When we take a look at this report, there were ranges of $19 trillion all the way through to $51 trillion in terms of how much money to U.S.'s GDP blacks and minorities in general could have added. Well, why is it that these demographics have been held back from their contribution to U.S. society, economically speaking, of course?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Thank you. And yes, racism is real here, and definitely that's one way it manifests itself. You can see that in terms of things like income and salary and employment. And it's true that when you hear the numbers you just rattled off, it sounds horrible, and most people want to make a moral judgment. What we have a more difficult time wrapping our heads around is there's actually a lot of people that actually are not embarrassed by that and don't want to change that. The status quo is also really real, and it is based on that racism.
Well, when we take a look at an example of this, if I can pick one, Darwin, let's take a look at Wall Street, for example. They are accused of discrimination, looking at what they have done, for example, in terms of banking, as I'm seeing over here, options in minority neighborhoods for mortgages, things of that nature. There has been discrimination against African Americans especially, but overall minorities. Why is that happening?
Right. And again, media wants to separate the two, because once you establish, as that data suggests, the numbers you shared, there is the racism. It's not by accident. And so in that sense, trying to change it is not simply identifying the problem. Wall Street, in that sense, becomes even more extreme, because you can also make a really compelling argument on the other side that their success is based on the racism that's baked into it. And we know that historically, if we go back to the history for Africans in this country, slavery was profitable. It's what set the U.S. aside from Europe and made the success that we had.
All right, let me thank our guest Darwin Fishman, lecturer in sociology at San Diego State University from California, spoke to us. Now, throughout the program, we're going to actually look at some case examples of either blacks, Latinos, or minorities, and the experiences that they have had when it comes to either racial discrimination or them being held back from contributing to the U.S. society.
We know very well that the pathway to generational wealth is owning a home, is having savings, is having life insurance, is having college savings accounts for our children. So we worked very hard to stay very simple and save to get to where we are. Over the years, the promotions, I think, helped as well, both for myself and for my husband, because even now we aren't